Let's have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 1:32 on the afternoon of Wednesday, March 24th, 2010. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Hegan, myself, Senator French, and Senator Wilikowski. And we have five bills on the calendar today, although SB 297 is going to be rolled forward to Friday's calendar for the information of the members here. And then that brings up SB 277, the next bill on our docket. It is Senator McGuire's bill. Senator McGuire, do you want to make any comments about the bill?
No, I'm going to let my staff.
Mr. Pulowski, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything you heard at the last hearing that you think needs amplification or further explanation?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe so. I think that the clarity that Mr. Foster brought to the issue, I think, was particularly insightful. And I think that at the end of the day, as the RCA recognized, it boils down to a policy call about competition and about access to the electricity market.
Any questions for Senator McGuire?
No, and thank you. And just to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for bringing Mr. Foster into the mix as well and for indulging our broader hearing in sort of looking at how we're going to deal with these independent power producers and renewable energy as a whole if we want to get more of it in our state. So thank you.
You're welcome. It is an interesting issue. Still haven't. It's an interesting issue. I like the bill. I think it's. I think that the thing I keep coming back to is the fact you've got two sophisticated business entities dealing with one another at an arm's length without being forced to strike a deal. I think that sort of market mechanism will do as much as anything else to protect consumers in the rail belt as anything else. Throwing in Mr. Foster's sort of leaning in favor of less regulation. The fact that it's a renewable, the fact that it's a wind project we're all excited about, all sort of militates in favor of moving the bill along. So unless there's further committee discussion, let's list a motion. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just add, I share your sentiments on the bill. I think the changes that were made in Senate Resources were good changes. And I think the concern with exempting from regulation is you don't want an IPP to be put in a position where they can really dominate the market. Yeah. And I think by limiting it to 65 megawatts, by having a sunset on this, I think it protects consumers. And so at this point, I'm certainly support moving the bill on, Mr. Chair. So with that, I would move that we move to SB 277 out of committee, along with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved. We'll take a short at ease for the paperwork. We are back on the record, and the next bill up is CS for House Bill number 319 by Representative Hawker. We do have a representative. We have a someone from his office here to answer questions. I think we took public testimony last time, closed public testimony. We've heard about the bill. Questions from members of the committee? I guess I have one question. Maybe you can come forward. Thanks. Ms. Lucky, welcome.
Thank you, Senator French, members of the committee. My name for the record is Julie Lucky, and I am staff to Representative Mike Hawker, District 32 in Anchorage.
Thank you, Ms. Lucky. Could you go over Section 5? Could you just, I see that I made some notes on my bill from last hearing, and could you go over Section 5 and how that command to execute federal firearms forms will work on the ground? How's that going to work out?
Senator French, I think this is one of the questions that we have often when we write statute that has no necessary remedy in statute. We are putting forth basically a duty for the chief law enforcement officer of a jurisdiction to execute a form. I am unsure really what the remedy would be, as there is not one specified in the law. I think that what we are doing is trying to create the duty in the law.
A more than gentle nudge, but a nudge with a questionable remedy. And so I'm just wondering whether the failure to do so might form the basis of an ethics complaint, for example, against a chief law enforcement officer or a chief administrative officer that didn't do that.
And Senator French, I can get some information for you. As I said, since there's no remedy in statute, I'm not quite certain what the remedy would be for a violation of this section.
And I understand, and you don't want to write may. On the other hand, you don't want to. And so I sort of sense the difficulty there. Why don't we do this? Why don't we hold it over one more hearing? We'll just try to find out what our options are there, and take it up in the next hearing. It just popped in my mind, and I just thought, you know, I want to make sure that that's not something. I don't want to create an expectation that we can't enforce it. On the other hand, I don't want to put municipal police departments across the state in a bind should this become law.
Okay. I understand the suggestion, Senator French.
Thank you so much. Further questions from members of the committee? Don't hear or see any. Thanks so much. Then that brings us to, we'll move on then to SB 46. And that is a bill brought to us by our colleague, Senator Kukesh. And we have Ms. Shockley here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us about your bill.
Okay. For the record, Dorothy Shockley, staff to Senator Kukesh. Okay, the CS for Senate Bill 46 pretty simply just puts the Child Support Civil Rule 90.3 guidelines into statute. In 87, the Alaska Supreme Court enacted the rule and admitted that it was a substantive law that the legislators could replace at any time. In the past 23 years since then, the legislator has not replaced the civil rule into actual law. So this bill proposes to do that. And one of the major problems with having a child support guideline set by a court rule is people affected by the current guidelines never have the chance to speak to individuals who have the power to make changes. I followed the review 2 years ago. You know, we get a lot of calls from constituents in regards to a lot of times, well, it's from most of our calls come from people who don't mind paying, but don't agree with the formula that they're made under the child support rule. So, you know, I encouraged our constituents and most everybody to write to this review committee, and which they did, and after, you know, the review committee made recommendations to the judges, and when it was all said and done, there wasn't, you know, much change made at all, and they held one statewide hearing, and it was a call-in. I think it lasted 1 hour at the most, and I just was really disappointed in how, you know, the people weren't really able to, especially in rural Alaska, to really talk to anybody in regards to their situation, and anybody who, you know, could make changes. And I asked, you know, well, what can we do? And I was told that to, you know, one of the things that it has never been done is to put it into statute so that people can actually speak to people who have the power to make changes. So that's kind of where the bill is, and would just appreciate your support in passing it. And if you have any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Shockley. Questions for Ms. Shockley? I don't see any, but stand by, because I'm certain that there'll be an opportunity for us to have questions as we work through some of the folks who are going to tell us about the bill. Now, I see Mr. Wolver's here. Maybe we'll turn to you, Mr. Wolver, because this is where the sort of the duty resides right now, is in your bailiwick. So if you'd come forward, put yourself on the record, tell us what you know about how it came to be that we do child support awards through a court rule and not a statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Doug Wolver, administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. Well, the previous speaker's right. This bill, the state's child support guidelines were initially adopted by the Supreme Court. That happened in 1987, shortly after the federal law required states to have guidelines. At that time, early 1987, then Governor Cooper came to the court system and told our then administrative director, Art Snowden, said, look, neither the legislature nor the governor wants anything to do with establishing these guidelines, and wondered if the court is the body that actually issues the orders, would be willing to adopt those guidelines. I'm not quite sure why we agreed to, but we said fine, we would. And we've done them, as the previous speaker said, ever since. It isn't a typical role for the court, but we did it at the request of the legislature and the governor. And I can go through kind of our process, at least the last process, of how we do this. And it's certainly true that the court rule process isn't quite, in some ways it's more accessible than the legislative process, and in other ways it's not as accessible. The federal law requires a review every 4 years, and that's what we do, is a review every 4 years. The Supreme Court, usually 2 years prior to the enactment of the new four-year changes, appoints a committee. One of the first things that happens is the court sends out for public comment, ask for questions and concerns and suggestions regarding our guidelines. They go out to, set posters in all of our court locations. We post notices in 32 different newspapers around the state. It's on our website. Notice that the changes are coming and being contemplated. Go out to all attorneys in a number of varieties. They're on emailed all people who have asked to be included. And one of the most important things we do is we send, this past year it was 34,000 notices to child support services to send out in their mailings, telling all the people who are making child support payments and receiving child support benefits that a change is coming, and asking for input. After that process goes on, committee begins meeting, all those comments come back. At this first round of comment we received this past time, about 250 comments from members of the public on the guidelines. And not all of them are helpful. I mean, it's just sometimes, like your public testimony, a lot of times what we get is a complaint about child support enforcement, or there'll be a complaint about the ex-spouse. Nevertheless, we send this out. These are the comments we make that are generated. All those comments then are summarized and organized by subject matter and distributed to the members of the committee. They use those comments as they come up with their draft proposal. Once the committee has a draft proposal, that again goes out for public comment. That goes out to, again, all the newspapers, members of the bar, it's in the bar rag on the website. Goes again to the 34,000 members or people who are participating through child support services, all court locations. Copies go to all legislators, and what gets sent out is not the entire rule, but a memo that summarizes the changes and a website to click on to see the entire rule. But the memo was the important thing. We got 80 comments from members of the public through that process. And then, as mentioned, there is one statewide teleconference. We haven't had a lot of success with that, though. We had 6 people participate in that teleconference. It hasn't been a very successful venue for us. More successful has been the mail-outs. But anyway, that's, and then the committee takes those comments into account and forwards its recommendation to the Supreme Court, which is, you know, the entity with the final authority on what the rule looks like. So that's an oversight of, at least overview of the process this past time.
So the ultimate responsibility for writing the words down that form the basis of the rule rests in the five justices of the Supreme Court?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And, okay, thank you. Senator Wilikowski.
If you're done with your questions, Mr. Chair. Just a couple. How similar are the current Rule 93 rules to the federal guidelines on child support?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't know. I could try to find out. I'm not personally all that familiar with 90.3.
And do you know, if I could, Mr. Chair, do you know if other states tend to have the child support rules in statutes or in court rules? Do you have any information on that?
Through the Chair, I don't. But again, I could find out if you're just
sort of out of your purview. But
yeah,
if either you or the bill sponsor knew, I would just be curious to hear.
I had the same question. While you're here, I know from my clerking days that child support issues take up an enormous amount of time. Mm-hmm. They're extremely time intensive. The arguments over how much money each side makes, changes in income, non-payment, requests for modification. I don't know what percentage of the caseload is in the civil side, but I'd say it's fairly high. Do you can you sort of give us a feeling for how much time of the court system is absorbed in child support matters?
Mr. Chairman, it is. It's a great deal. In fact, a couple of weeks ago when I was here asking for a new Superior Court judge in Anchorage, which you passed out of the Senate this morning, one of the reasons I gave at that time was unrepresented litigants in family law cases, and that what that category is child support. They come back over and over and over, and one of the reasons we only ask for one judge is because we want to add some staff, part of whose job will be to help calculate child support payments. The judges do it now. There are actually quite a few legal issues involved in making child support calculations and what's deductible and what's not, what's included is in income and what is not included in income. The courts spend a tremendous amount of time on child support issues.
Further questions for Mr. Wolliver? Don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
for being here. We have online also John Maloney from CSSD. Mr. Maloney, can you hear me?
Mr. Chairman, it's John Maloney. Yes, I can.
Very good. If you'd put yourself on the record, and we'll be glad to hear your testimony.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, my name is John Maloney. I'm the Director of Child Support Services Division. I'm really here just to answer questions.
Do you, then I'll ask this to start out with. When do you suggest changes to the court rule? That is, are you a participant in the process that results in modifications to the guidelines?
Mr. Chairman, most recently, Stacy Steinberg from the Attorney General's Office is an assistant AG who handles the section that represents Child Support Services Division, has been a member of that committee.
So when CSSD wants a change, you work through Ms. Steinberg to get the change made before the committee?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
And we'll ask her about her experience and so forth. Anything you want to add to the conversation so far about the bill or child support in general?
Not really, Mr. Chairman. The only thing that the prior speaker had mentioned, or someone had asked the question about federal regulations or federal law, the federal regulations that cover setting guidelines is 45 CFR 302.56, and it basically states what the guidelines must consider, and it's not very detailed, actually. It's fairly open for interpretation by the state, other than the fact that it does have to be reviewed every 4 years.
Thank you. Let's turn to Stacy Steinberg.
Thank you. This is Stacy Steinberg. I'm testifying from Anchorage.
Very good. Ms. Steinberg, tell us about your involvement in this topic in general, and then maybe more specifically about your experience insofar as it relates to your ability to get changes made or the administration's ability to get changes made in child support guidelines.
Yes. My name is Stacey Steinberg. I am the section chief for the collections and support section at the Attorney General's office. And what our section is, we are the attorneys for Child Support Services Division. So whenever they have legal issues or if they have anything that must go to court, our attorneys take those issues to court. My experience is that that is correct that I served on the last review committee that reviewed the child support guidelines, and it is a pretty extensive process. It was the first year that I was involved, and it does take a considerable amount of time, and there's on the committee there is a makeup of some private attorneys, as well as there's a judge that's the chair of the committee, and I was also on the committee, and certainly wouldn't bring any concerns from the Child Support Services Division to the committee's attention. And I don't believe in this last review, certainly from CSSC's perspective, we didn't have any, I don't recall that we asked for any specific changes to the rule. I know we did work with the committee, we did make some changes to the court form for child support to make things a little bit more efficient for collecting child support. Not sure if there's any other specific questions about my role on the last review committee reviewing 90.3.
Maybe I'll just ask more generally whether you know if the administration is taking a position on the bill.
I'd probably defer that to the CSSD director, John Maloney.
Let's go back to Mr. Maloney just for a minute. Mr. Maloney, are you still with us?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
And did you hear the question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We have no objection to the bill. We simply use those guidelines to do the calculations that we do for establishing child support orders, whether it would be a statute or in a court rule. It's simply our guide with which we do the calculations.
Thank you. Follow-up question from Senator Witlakowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does CSSED get involved when, every 4 years when the judiciary is reviewing the numbers?
Through the chair, Senator Witlakowski, like I said, most of the time the attorney that represents us, the head of that section, usually is a member of that committee, and that's our really only involvement.
And since we'd be setting, and I guess I don't know if your intention is to move the bill or hold the bill, Mr. Chair. I guess at some point, if we do decide we want to go ahead with this bill, I'd be curious to hear your position on the numbers. For instance, 20% payment after of adjusted annual income for one child, 27% for two children, the payments on health insurance and things of that nature. And so just I guess something for the future. Do you have a position on the numbers that are in the statute? Are they fair? Are they equitable? Do we need to be higher or lower?
Through the chair, Senator Witlakowski, I really don't, from the standpoint of I haven't really done any study or had any study commission to do that, and I would think that would take a real economic study, which I think there was some done originally when the 90.3 was set up, but that would be the type of thing that you would need if we really wanted to discuss whether or not those at 20% or 27% represented a fair and equitable situation.
Thank you. Follow-up questions for Mr. Maloney. Ms. Shockley, something you wanted to add?
Well, yes, Dorothy Shockley, staff to Senator Kukesh. I just wanted to say that in the rule, the 90.3 rule, those are the numbers that were in it. And so we just, you know, just wanted to make it as simple as possible and just take the rule and put it into statute and then look at some of the things that we might want to change.
Yeah, and I appreciate you, because I was sitting here wondering if you had just pulled the numbers out of the rule exactly, and you're saying you are. So thank you. I appreciate that.
Let's turn back to Ms. Steinberg. I am in the committee. Just got kind of late this afternoon a letter from you, Ms. Steinberg, I believe to Senator Kukesh, outlining a few of the concerns you had regarding the bill. And I understand we just late this afternoon got a CS. We did not distribute because the bill is going to be held over. But let me just ask generically whether you are whether the changes envisioned by the CS that you had input to take care of your issues, or whether there's still some outstanding concerns you have with the bill.
I guess I did prepare a letter to Senator Kukesh to address some of the issues, and I'm looking at the CS for Senate Bill 46, 26-LS0279/P as in Paul. And I did have a few, just some legal concerns about one particular section that I'd be more than happy to address. I haven't seen any new committee substitute. My understanding that there was one being drafted, but I haven't seen the new committee substitute at this point.
You know, I think what we're going to do is we are on /PPAPA, but I think what we'll do is wait until we vote. We're all on the same document. It may just be repetitive for us to go through concerns you have with this /P if some of them have been addressed by the CS. We'll, a subsequent hearing, get the CS in front of us and then make sure we're sort of all working at one time off of one document. Does that make sense?
Certainly. Since if those issues I brought up in my letter have been resolved, then certainly we can move on.
Very good. The one thing that jumped out at me was just your attachment number 2 and some concerns about how medical costs are to be divided under this bill. Although I guess I kind of have to wonder whether, if this bill is simply the court rule pulled into a statute, how the problems don't exist now. I mean, if there's a problem with the court rule, there's going to be a problem with the statute and vice versa, since they're both the same right at the moment.
Well, Chair Hall, if I can address that, is that one thing that came up is originally, in the very beginning, the bill simply mimicked 90.3, and there weren't any significant legal issues that needed a few tweaks because the court rule addresses court issues, and there was a few things that CSB doesn't address, so we needed to make a few changes to make sure that the court rule that was being incorporated into a statute would also cover CSSD, because CSSD does follow the court rule when the agency sets administrative support orders. And those issues were resolved. I think where it became problematic is that in 2008, there were some federal regulations passed that CSSD is required to comply with for federal funding that required the addition of, quote, cash medical support, and also some provisions that would deal with defining the reasonableness of health insurance and the accessibility of health insurance. So, and then those aspects were added to this, the current form of the bill, this committee substitute. And the problem is that the cash medical support is, it was a new addition. It wasn't in 90.3. So when it was added, I think it's just important that it makes sense. And since it's something new and it's a little bit complicated, that that it will actually work in real life, and that it meets the requirements of the federal regulation, but also that it will actually work. And I think when I read through this bill, there were just some questions about, now that the cash medical support is added, which that's good because it needs to be in the bill to comply with federal regulations, but when you actually start applying it, it wasn't crystal clear on how some of the uncovered medical expenses would be handled and who would pay them, and it seemed like there was a little bit of question on that, and that's the main point in my letter was to ensure that the additions of cash medical support, which currently aren't in 90.3, will legally work in this new statute.
Very good. I think we'll. I think the best thing to do is get the most recent version of the bill in front of us, and that way we'll do it once instead of doing it several times. Senator Wilikowski does have a question.
Thank you. I don't know if you're the proper person, but I just sort of have a fundamental question about 90.3. Is that substantive law, or is that just guidelines? And if it is sort of substantive law, how is it that the Supreme Court or the judiciary was able to adopt substantive law?
Through the chair, I think Mr. Wolliver gave a nice history of how the civil rule came about. I can tell you that the constitutionality of this civil rule 90.3 has been challenged, and the Supreme Court has ruled that it is constitutional. And it is substantive in that it does set how child support is set in each court case. So it is substantive in that sense, but it is a court rule that only applies to the court. CSSC does have a separate regulation where they specifically say we're going to follow Civil Rule 90.3.
Well, and the one thing I've learned is that he who has the last say is the one who makes the decision. So Supreme Court
is right. True enough. Ms. Steinberg, I don't see any further questions for you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me turn to Jean Michelle, because I do have one question for our drafter, Ms. Michelle, if you're on the line.
Yes, Chairman French, this is Jean Michelle with Legal Services.
I was looking on pages 11 and 12 of the bill, and I see probably the thing that caught my eye the most significantly was on page 12, saying non-applicability of a two-thirds vote requirement. I am so accustomed to changing court rules by a two-thirds vote that I was interested to see that provision in the bill and thought I'd get you on the record to explain why it's there and how you came to that conclusion.
Yes. Again, this is Jean Michelle with Legal Services for the legislature. The reason that's in there is because this is construed by our office to be a substantive rule, and therefore, since we're not affecting judicial procedure that would require a two-thirds vote and by the legislature, it's not required for this bill.
Very interesting. Further questions for the drafter? Senator Wilikowski.
I'm going to need a little more explanation on that, because if we're changing a court rule, I mean, we're basically getting rid of a court rule. How can we do that without a two-thirds vote? Maybe Doug.
I see Doug. Mr. Wolliver, actually, Ms. Michelle, hold off. We're going to get Doug Wolliver in front of us. Go ahead.
Doug Wolliver from the court system. The Supreme Court adopts rules under two provisions of the Constitution. Article 4, Section 15 is the rules of practice and procedure. Article 4, Section 1 is the inherent authority of the court. And in following 90.3 in the rules of court, it says that this rule is adopted pursuant to that authority under Article 4, Section 1, and is not subject to the supermajority requirements that a rule of practice and procedure would be subject to in terms of legislative change. So the rule itself says this is a substantive rule and the legislature can change it with a simple majority vote.
I guess I never really stopped and given it much thought really until now as to why we needed a two-thirds vote to change a court rule, and I guess it's on separation of powers. We're reaching into their procedures. We're monkeying with their procedures, and so we want to be darn sure that we've got a bunch of people that think it's a good idea, two-thirds vote. Senator Wilikowski.
And it's an interesting question. I mean, it's sort of, with all due respect to the court, it's sort of circular logic that the court can't adopt substantive laws, but here they have adopted a substantive law, and yet we don't need two-thirds rule to change it. But
what if they say we do?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman,
can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry, this is Jean Michelle again.
Yes.
Just to clarify Doug's comments, the court adopts both procedural and substantive rules, and the substantive rules are really within the purview of both the judicial and the legislative branch. And the court, in this case, as Doug pointed out, told the legislature that we could amend or adopt this rule without a two-thirds vote. So we're all in agreement that this is not a procedural rule that the court would have more control over.
And just maybe for my broader knowledge, are there other instances of substantive rules that the court has adopted besides 90.3?
Yes, there are, but it would take me some time to point those out to you.
That we're going to hold the bill over, and the part of the reason we're holding the bill over is that we have yet to hear from some of the folks on the ground, the practitioners, who I mean, this is an area where lots and lots of lawyers work day in and day out to administer these rules. And I'd like to hear from the family law section. From there's a Mr. Kirk out there, I think, who has been in support of the bill, and they're both unavailable today. So, for that reason, because it is a fairly significant change, we are going to hold the bill over to a future hearing. So, for the time being, Ms. Michelle, anything else you wanted to add?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilber.
No, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. All right, let's. Is there anyone else here in the room today who'd like to testify about some of these fascinating legal questions? Don't hear or see anybody. Anybody else online? Don't hear or see anybody. We will, I'm not going to close public testimony. We are going to keep it open for the time being, and we'll hold the bill over to a future hearing. So, thanks so much. Next, that brings up CS for Senate Bill number 63. A bill we've heard. Oh, no. I'm thinking of something else. It's a new one. Welcome, Ms. Cha. Hi. Nice to have you here. Put yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is Esther Cha, staff to Senator Liesl McGuire.
Very good. Tell us about your bill.
Okay.
We trust you. Don't worry.
As you well know from many of our trust bills in the past, the climate for trust and estate planning is highly competitive, and the trust business is a multi-billion dollar sector that often crosses state lines in order to take advantage of more attractive state trust laws. In 1997, Alaska became the first state to establish a law that allows a person to form an irrevocable trust and be a discretionary beneficiary of the trust, and if the trust has a spendthrift clause, protect the trust assets from the settlor's creditors. And to give a little background, because trust can be very complicated, in trust, there are three parties. There is the settlor, who is also known as the trust maker. They are also referred to as the grantor or the testator. There is the trustee, who can be an individual or an institution, and then there are beneficiaries. The settlor designates whether or not a beneficiary is discretionary, which means that the payment of distributions is determined based on the discretion of the trustee instead of the settlor assigning in the trust document how much and when payments will be distributed. And with discretionary beneficiaries, trustees may be given standards by which to exercise discretion. For example, they have a HEMS standard, which stands for Health, Education, Management, and Support. If the trust has a spendthrift provision, a creditor cannot force the trustee to pay money directly to the creditor. Instead, the creditor must wait until the assets are paid out to the beneficiary, at which time the creditor can seize the assets. So Alaska established that assets in a trust will be protected from a settlor's creditors if he designates himself as a discretionary beneficiary, provided that he has no current claims pending. And since Alaska enacted the statute, numerous other states have enacted similar statutes. And at present, 12 states allow this type of trust. The CS for Senate Bill 63 would upgrade Alaska's trust statutes by adopting provisions that have been adopted by other states. And this bill provides the following amendments. It clarifies the burden of proof by which a creditor must meet to establish that a transfer in trust was done with the intent to defraud them, as well as providing that a transfer restriction on a trust interest is enforceable even if the settlor has certain listed powers relating to the appointment, removal, and replacement of a trustee, trust protector, or an advisor. And it also clarifies that a spendthrift provision will apply to a trust if distributions are made under the exercise of a discretion by a trustee who is not the settlor, whether or not the exercise of discretion is governed by a standard. And it provides that the spendthrift provision in a trust will apply even though the trustee may distribute income or principal to the settlor to pay income taxes. And as you know, Senate Bill 63 is part of an ongoing effort to modernize our trust laws, and by doing so, to create jobs and revenue and to diversify our economy and continue making Alaska attractive to trust business.
Chair, thank you. I do have a question, but I noticed that we have Terry Bannister, Jonathan Blockmacher, Dave Schaftel, Janet Temple. Three of those four are here to answer questions. Mr. Blockmacher wants to testify about the bill, and we have a Richard Hompesch signed up as well to testify. Anything else from you before we turn to them? Senator McGuire, no?
Nope.
No? Thank you. Stand by. We may be back to you for questions. Let's turn first to Mr. Blockmacher, who says he wants to testify. Mr. Blockmacher, welcome to the committee. If you can hear me, put yourself on the record and let us know what you think about this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I've been involved with the drafting of Alaska's trust laws since 1997. We've been able to keep them the very best and try to make other states catch up with us, so Alaska is regarded as the best place and receives a good share of the business. This has produced a lot of revenue for the state. This and other bills has produced millions of dollars of tax revenues to the state, which otherwise it would not have received. And it also has produced a number of jobs. It's also made the bar in Alaska, I think, regarded as one of the most sophisticated in the country. And I think that spills over in giving Alaska an aura of being sophisticated in almost all financial services matters. So that's great. As Ms. Chaw said, this bill is really kind of a catch-up bill on our part, where some states have tried to leapfrog ahead of Alaska. We still think we're the best, but they have certain provisions which we think we need to put in because questions are raised by people who are thinking about creating trusts, and we want to make sure that we're at least as good as any other state's law and better in some respects. And in fact, just this fall, in private letter ruling 2009-44002, which was issued by the Internal Revenue Service, it held that an individual could create an Alaska trust of which he or she was a discretionary beneficiary, and yet the assets would not be includable in that person's estate at the time that he or she died. That is the first ruling ever under these new state statutes. There are approximately 12 of them right now, and it was very, very good news to everybody involved in the Alaska trust industry. We also believe, because of the special way the Alaska statute is structured, that the only other state that might possibly fall under the purview of that favorable ruling from the IRS is Nevada, which is relatively new on the scene with this kind of legislation. Delaware, who adopted its statute about 30 days after Alaska did in 1997, we don't think will be able to get the ruling because we think that their statute is not drafted as well as ours is. So, Mr. Chairman, that is my position on it, and I would urge your committee to please approve it. Thank you for letting me testify.
Mr. Blockmacher, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Blockmacher? I don't see any. Let's turn to Richard Hompesch. I hope I'm saying your name right, sir. If you're on the line, please go ahead and put yourself on the record, state your name and affiliation, if any, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Richard Hompesch. I'm an attorney in private practice in Fairbanks, and I support Senate Bill 63. I agree with the comments of Mr. Blockmacher, and I think that Alaska has received national recognition for its trust legislation. It's made a difference in my practice, and it's also had an impact on the estate planning that we do in Fairbanks for our clients here. And so I urge the committee to please pass this legislation.
Mr. Hompish, thank you. I guess I'll just ask, I mean, do you get out-of-state individuals who come to you seeking to create trusts under Alaska law because of the quality of our trust laws?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I do. This morning I was speaking with a gentleman from Dallas, Texas. And the day before yesterday, I was speaking with an attorney from Miami. The attorney from Miami has a wealthy client who is placing, I think it's 4 trusts in Alaska. One from Texas is going to be moving, the trust from the attorney in Miami are originally from Ohio. The trust from the attorney in Dallas was a Texas trust who's moving here, all because our laws are more favorable than those states.
Quite remarkable. Thank you for that testimony. It helps us understand what we're doing. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We also have on the line Mr. Shaftel. Anything you want to add to the discussion so far?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I'm a member of this informal group of attorneys and trust officers who have been working with the legislature for the past dozen years. And similarly to Rich Hompish's experience, I've had the same experience of having many Alaska clients wanting to use these new developments for their own personal estate planning. And also I've had business from outside of Alaska where residents of other states have wanted to take advantage of our laws. So I was involved in the drafting of these particular provisions. I think they're good additions. They strengthen our law with respect to this type of trust, and would recommend that the committee give very serious consideration to approving this bill. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Shaftel. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I stepped out for a minute. I don't know if I missed this question or not, but the one thing I'm just curious about is, does this create additional work for our court system? I don't see a fiscal note in here from the court system. I'm just curious if all these additional people coming here does have that effect.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't think that this particular bill or these provisions do directly create additional work for the court system. I don't see where people, if these matters were litigated, they'd probably be litigated. If we're talking about non-residents of Alaska, they'd probably be litigated in bankruptcy court or in the state courts of the residents of the settlor rather than Alaska.
Follow-up? Just as a matter of housekeeping, it has been brought to my attention that we need to move to adopt the /P version of this CS, if I can get a motion to do that.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
It's been moved that we adopt the /P as our working document. Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, that's the document before us. We also have online Janet Temple from Alaska USA. Ms. Temple, I have you on to answer questions, but I'll give you the opportunity to say a few words if you'd like to. Just put yourself on the record and go ahead.
Thank you. I am a senior trust officer at Alaska USA Trust Company, and we are the trustee on a number of these trusts that have been set up under this Alaska Trust Act. We are trustee for both Alaska residents and for non-residents. And I agree completely with Mr. Blattmacher, Mr. Hompish, and Mr. Shaftel that it is very important that we keep our trust laws updated. And so we completely support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else online would like to testify about SB 63? Anyone else in the room? Don't hear or see anyone. I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony and hold the bill over to a future hearing, because I like to hold bills over, especially when they're a little bit tricky like this one. Not that they're tricky for people that work in the matter and the field, but they are for me, who does not. So unless there's anything else to come before the committee, we're going to stand adjournment.